Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind, in your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. Day Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when live and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is MJ Network, MJ Memory of My Sister Marcia Joyce, and we have the author of Nevertheless, Jeffrey Wells, is here. The day two 12-year-olds stumble across a secret tunnel being used to smuggle opiates is the day they start to save their dads. Pablo is a dreamer kid whose father is always one step away from deportment, though their octogenarian mentor warns them about the infamous Prohibition Tunnel. That's not going to stop them, these two, and wait till you hear about their adventures. Good morning, and how are you? Welcome to MJ Network. And this is an important topic about opiates, people.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
I'm so excited that you're here. So why did you decide to write a YA novel, which I think not enough people write, and why did you decide to choose opiates as your primary topic, which I think is probably the reason why I picked up the book and couldn't put it down?
You know, I wanted to write a story about two kids who get deeper and deeper and deeper to a very serious problem in their community and then eventually in the, you know, nationally and internationally for that matter. But it starts out very simply. The book is written from the point of view of two 12-year-olds, so it's really a middle grade read. It's not really YA, positioned as middle grade. And in other words, basically 12-year-olds or tweens, kids, you know, transitioning from being children into young adults. And that's the target for me because I knew that this is where the problem starts in schools, where you have peer pressure and that sort of thing. And they are tempted to try these things out, and it leads to another, and it gets very serious very quickly. So that's basically why I thought I'd start off with a simple, apparently simple story, and then see how it escalates and becomes more complex as they get deeper and deeper and more exposed to this problem.
Peer pressure is serious because I've seen it. I saw it when I taught. I heard kids say, "You won't be my friend if you do this. You won't be my friend if you do this." I stopped it right away. And it wasn't even in my classes because they would never do that. So that's important, too, because a lot of kids say, well, you know, I want to be popular, so I'll do this. They don't realize that they're only going to get in trouble. So
Yeah. Tell
us about Pablo and Mindy and how and why their friendship evolved and what problems did their families face.
So Pablo and Mindy come from very diverse or very different backgrounds. Pablo is a dreamer kid. In other words, he's an alien to this country. He's from Mexico. His family's from Mexico. And he has dreamer status, which allows him to stay in the country through his education. And his father is a laborer, tree-trimming. You know, he cuts down trees. And his mother is very smart, and she's really the brains in the family. And she works with him to boost his education because she knows he's got a tough road to go, not being familiar with the language, being bullied at school, being smaller than the other kids. And so Pop develops somewhat of a thick skin. And we begin to feel that he's going to make it because of his charm and his determination. Mindy is the exact opposite. You know, she's the daughter of a doctor.
Mm.
They live in a nice residential neighborhood. You know, two cars, plush carpeting. She has everything she needs. She's tall, she's blonde, she's fair-haired, blue-eyed, and does well in school. Pablo does not do well, except in art. He's very artistic. The reason that they get together is one word, and that is soccer. So Pablo grew up in Mexico kicking around a soccer ball. And so to him, it's second nature. Well, that was not the case with Mindy. When they meet, they very soon realize that they're both. Mindy would like to be better, and when she sees how he controls the ball and how he's able to place the ball and pass it, etc., they decide to practice together. And so their friendship begins to build on the soccer field.
So what happens when Mindy's aware of her father's problem? Her mother doesn't seem to be that concerned. And what gets me is that do doctors prescribe opiates for themselves? Can they write their own prescription?
They in this story, they do. I don't think it's totally done.
Yeah.
What happens in a lot of cases with opioid addiction is that it starts off with an injury, and opioids are prescribed, and it soon becomes weighing, and the habit develops that very soon the patient becomes the addict. So. And that's the case with him. You know, he was T-boned in an intersection. It crushed his shoulder and his arm, so he has it in a sling. But after a while, Mindy begins to realize, you know, your arm's okay. You can sling it, not really doing much. And yet you still take off the afternoon from your practice. You come home and you sleep away the rest of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And begins to suspect that the painkillers, you know, in quotation marks, are opioids. Actually, she doesn't know what they are, but eventually she does find out. And the mother and her mother, who's very domineering, doesn't want Mindy to worry about it. So she says, you know, she'll get over it. This is the way it goes. He's healing, and don't worry about it. I'm sure he'll be fine. And Mindy knows that things are fine. So there's this tension in the family where the mother is deceiving her daughter, and the dad is not being forthright with her about his own pain.
Now, this is an interesting point. There are legitimate painkillers, but why are they laced with poison? And I know my cousin, the person I told you about, takes fentanyl too. Why is that so popular?
Well, there's the supply side reason, and then there's the demand side. So the supply side reason is that fentanyl costs about one-tenth to produce, to manufacture. It's a completely synthetic opioid. Not very difficult to manufacture. Started in China, and now it's being manufactured in Mexico, America. And so they're able to, components of the drugs are relatively inexpensive, and they're able to flood the market. The reason that fentanyl is used is, in fact, it is a legitimate opioid, but it's about 1,000 times more effective in killing the dopamine response or stimulating the dopamine response. And what the doctors begin in this story, what Mindy's father begins to do is source the fentanyl from other sources other than the pharmaceuticals. In other words, street drugs. The reason go ahead.
No, go ahead. I got it.
So the reason that this story is a little different in the sense that I did not story about regular opioid addiction, because that's been done before, and there's some terrific books on the subject, including one books. However, what I really wanted to concentrate on is how they get involved in actually exposing the supply chain drugs, because I found that more interesting. The crime that the mastermind would have began, and they know that their clients, are the drug users. And the drug users can use those drugs so long as there is an antidote. And so what they'll go from, getting to preventing themselves from overdosing by getting overdosed, the antidote, and then until the next phase, and then they go through this cycle. And the logic from the masterminds who want to get rid of the gangs is, if we put the poison, the fentanyl, into the antidote, those people who are used to just taking the antidote back down, that's the crime. So the people who are about to overdose, in fact, do overdose because the fentanyl stimulates the overdose instead of it being mitigated by the antidote. So that's how this crime is constructed in the story.
That's scary.
Very scary, and a very evil crime, because when people are addicted and they're about to overdose, the last thing they need, of course, is to have to deal with in fact get a poison of them.
All I know is that when my nephew a couple of years ago had a spleen operation because he got hurt playing baseball, and the first thing they gave him was Vicodin, and I said to him, you don't want to take that. He took it once, and he said, never again. They gave it to him in the hospital, and I said, why are they giving you opiates when you can just take, Motrin or something? And that's what's scary. So Mindy becomes worried about her father because he's dope. And he doesn't see his problems, does he? Because somebody like that is just going to sort of ignore it. And how do you deal with that? How did she deal with that?
Mindy's father is a doctor, so he's aware that he's probably addicted. But he's so arrogant in the fact that he can control his addiction that he doesn't consider it a big problem. And Mindy, of course, sees through that. What is the second part of your question?
Well, why doesn't a doctor, I've seen grown-ups say, I'm going to take an oxycodone, I'm going to take this. They don't realize that they're getting addicted. How come the doctor and anybody else doesn't see that they have a problem? Because I said it to this person in my family. I said, you have a problem. You literally can't live without pain meds. And there came a situation a while ago where the person couldn't take all the pain meds because they had to take different meds for something else. So how do these people, why don't they realize that they have a problem?
I think there's a sense of denial. And also the other thing is they might recognize that it's a problem, but it's not serious enough for them to say, I can't take this, period. I can't take it anymore. They're justified, I will take a lesser dose, I'll wait for a little bit, and then I'll just continue because it's something listen to it. I have to take it. There are a ton of reasons why people will not face the reality that this path leads to death ultimately. And the fact that these drugs like Narcan and these antidote drugs can help them through until they feel better and then they can continue is a reason why they don't feel like they're up, because when there's no safety net and there's no Narcan, it's the end of the road for them.
Now this gets interesting. How do they meet Peter King? And how does this start a chain of events that leads them into danger? And why did they trust him? Because kids should not trust strangers.
Right. So the story starts out with Pablo, or Mindy helping Pablo find a penknife that he dropped in the forest. And he was helping his dad cut down trees, dropped his penknife, and it persuades him to help him. And when they're looking, they find a hole in the ground. You know, and it's not a hole in the ground, it's actually the opening of a tunnel that leads down the block to a mill on the creek. And, you know, they think it's pretty interesting, and they notice that there's a cable running down the hole. And very soon, a truck pulls up and collects something and drives off. And as the driver is driving away, he hits and tries to chase them. And they run away from him into a sunflower field. And that is the farm of Peter, who's the octogenarian. And the reason they trust him is because he's very upfront about, you know, his intention, which is to simply take them back, keep them out of danger, take them back to where they were. He tells Mindy to call her mother because he knows how this looks. An old man, young girl, etc. This does not look good. So he has to call her. And he speaks to her. He says, look, I'm bringing her home. I'll be a few months. And then I'll drop her off. And so I established very, very clearly that this is not a story about an old man abusing kids. This is the story is about the clear drive of this story is about Mindy and Pablo bonding in their friendship and determining how to stop this problem. Now, Peter serves as a pure character in the sense that he is their mentor. He gives them wise advice. He gives them guidance because both their parents, both families, are dysfunctional. So they look to him for advice, and that's what he supplies.
Which is not good. So there's a couple of questions altogether. There's a boat that comes into play. So Pablo wants to go out on his boat, and when he and his father wind up on it, they witness something that they shouldn't see. So what does he do about it?
Right. Yeah, so Peter, you know, is at the end of at the end of life, basically. And he's packed up his house and his farm, and he's going to stay in an assisted living. And one of the things he has to get rid of is his boat. Now, because he's met Pablo, he knows that Pablo loves to go fishing with his dad, but they don't have a boat. So he figures, you know, why don't I give you this? You can take it. It's yours. I'm not going to get much for it. And if I sell it, it's probably going to be used for some, you know, transportation to some luxury yachts. And I've had such a great life with this. I'd love it to go to a family that really appreciates it. And so Pablo says, well, listen, that's fantastic. He accepts the boat. He said, why don't you come out fishing last time? And with my dad. So the two men, Peter and Pablo's father, Federico, go out fishing with Pablo in the boat the last time. And on the way back, Peter goes up the creek past the mill, and he stops at the mill. And he said, you know, I just want to take a quick look at this because I can't get to it from the other side. Now I'm in the boat. I can just get up here on the deck and see see it for himself, for his business, because that's where he died of alcohol poisoning. So traditionally, or what the story of the mill is, that during prohibition days, they would use this mill to smuggle bootleg liquor, what they called hooch, into Long Island. And years later, after the Second World War, he and his brother went back there and they found the tunnel. And in the tunnel were these old crates of prohibition liquor, and his brother sort of half joked, well, let's see what this tastes like. And he took a few gulps, and of course it was not, it was poisonous because it was wood alcohol. It wasn't the other type that goes into liquor. And he died as a result. And so Peter has this of his brother. Anyway, so it's curiosity that takes him there, and he takes Pablo and his father into the mill because it's deserted. But they very soon realize that it's actually not deserted. There are men working upstairs, and what they find out later is that they are packaging the drugs for distribution. And now they're stuck. They can't leave because if they can't leave, they'll be seen. And these are heavy criminals. To the extent that there's a dispute upstairs, and one of the men is taken down the stairs, he's dropped down into the water, and with a rope around his neck, they get a murderous suicide. And they, Pablo and Peter and his father basically are witnessing it today, and they can't leave. And the way Pablo is able to escape is because he's light and small and agile. They give him a leg up to a top ventilation window where they're hiding out in an old larder. And he drops down, and the bad guy almost sees him, so he jumps into the water, and before he knows it, he has to grapple with the issue of hiding the boat so the bad guys don't see it, or save the drowning man, and he's going to drown in a matter of minutes with a rope around his neck. So that's how they become exposed to the crime.
So we have Pablo. The kid is really smart. I've got to admit, this kid's really smart, and he disappears.
Yeah.
And the police are looking for him, but he's not going to find him. So how does he communicate with his mother, with Mindy? And if his mother is deported, what's going to happen? So how does his disappearing work in his favor, in a sense? Kid is really smart. You got to give him credit.
Yeah, he's very gutsy. His logic is, because my dad is in the mill, and I've been able to communicate through my cell phone that there's something going on, so the police are on the way. If they find his dad in the company of these drug dealers, he's going to be labeled as part of the gang, part of the
yeah.
So the best tactic for Pablo to take is to in fact disappear and become a missing child. And so he runs away from his family. He runs away. And he puts the word out to Mindy, who puts it to the police, and now the police are looking for a missing child. And Pablo's father is taken temporarily in for questioning, but they get killed as soon as they find this man's child, who is Pablo. And so that's his tactic, and it's very smart because he knows that to save his dad, who cannot be arrested again or he'll be deported.
Yeah.
They first need to find his son. And so he changes the priority for law enforcement. Find him instead of prosecuting his dad.
That's amazing, because how many kids would do that? So we've got the sneaky guy, Peter, offers them a deal. What would that do for him and why? And when Pablo tries to save a man twice, the second time, why does he realize he's in the middle of this big fat mess?
You're talking about Peter?
Yeah, and Pablo.
Yeah. Well, Peter is determined to help them.
Mm.
And one of the ways he can do that is to give them temporary a shelter, not shelter, but a place to hang out while they try and figure out how they're going to get the boat. Because if they get the boat back, they can prove that they were part of the gang. They were out fishing. But they can't because the tide is too high. And they can't get the boat from under the deck, which is what we pop up in the boat after the drowning man incident. And so Peter continues to help them in that way. Does that answer your question?
Yep. Now we've got Juan. Who is Juan? Why does he help him and why? And how does law enforcement get involved in this whole mess?
Yeah, so if we jump ahead on the story, it eventually becomes clear to Pablo that he needs to go back to the mill.
Mm.
And he does this. He is, in fact, captured by the bad guys. And they put him onto a rum-runner boat. A rum-runner boat is a long, thin motorboat, extremely powerful motors, that goes, 174 miles an hour on the water. And they head out from the sound into the Atlantic. And he's been captured, basically. And when he's on the ship, which is a fish factory that is doubling up as a fentanyl manufacturing facility supplied by a Chinese boat. He befriends the short order cook on the boat. His name is Juan.
Mm-hmm.
And Juan and he are both, they're both illegal aliens. They're both don't want to be shipped back to Mexico. So they become friends. And Juan helps him with his computer and hides him out and, just to generally facilitates Pablo as he escapes everybody on the ship.
But then the police get involved, right? And what happens when Mindy learns what her father's really doing? And, tell us about the processing plant and the men involved. That's very common, isn't it?
The processing plant on the ship you're talking about.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if it's common. I wanted to place it on a fish factory because it raises the question of, environmentally healthy fish. And the paradox is that while they're being processed, they're also processing poison. So there's that paradox. And he is able to discover what's going on. In fact, he was supposed to be a subject of the child subject of the drugs. And when he is able to engineer one of the guys going overboard on the ship, and they're all looking for him, it's man overboard, he finds the person who's running what they call the hospital, which is really the research facility for the fentanyl, is in fact Mindy's dad. So Mindy, in fact, running the show. And they go from there. Pablo is able to get in touch with the Coast Guard and I don't want to give away the ending, but that's how it goes from there.
I don't want to give away the ending either, but this chapter really got me. The one that you titled Uploading on Paradise, that was scary. And what is the picture we get about the father? And then we'll go to more about her and she and her mother and Pablo. They're flown to Bermuda. How come?
So when Peter's on the motorboat going out into the Atlantic, he was able to send a garbled message saying, help me, basically. And they triangulate, they get the message, they bring in law enforcement, who brings in the FBI, and they figure out that she's going to this facility, a fish factory, halfway between Long Island and Bermuda. And the senior FBI officer requests that the family be available for interviewing because they can't interview a minor without parental consent. And so they're put on a plane, Mindy's mother and Pablo's mother as well. And they told to stand by while they prepared to make a landing on the fish factory. But by the time they do, Pablo's already left. So they missed him. They're able to bring in all the rest of the people, but they still don't have the kids, or they still don't have Pablo. So that's really why.
So what happens when Peter and Pablo are arrested? And then Peter is released. How come? That didn't seem fair.
Yeah. Peter's never... Oh, right. So this is going back earlier in the story. So after the mill is discovered and the cops have arrived, they're told to come out. And because Peter's white and, you know, he knows the local arresting officer because they've helped him on his sunflower farm with vandalism. They tell him to go, whereas Federico is highly suspect because he's a Latina man, and they think it's a smuggling operation. So there's definitely discrimination profiling, and Pablo's father is the victim of that. And no, it's not fair, and this is explained, Peter explains this to Pablo, that this is the real world, this it works, and you better understand it because this is the reality of how discrimination works.
So this is, before I forget, don't want to forget, Monday is going to probably be one of the most exciting interviews I've ever done. It's my student from my school. And Michael Taylor, yeah, this is a student that he blames me for his success. I'll take it. My friend Tom, who died, he was in his class, and Michael Taylor became my situation. He was a tough kid that turned out to be amazing. He created something for young black children, white children, Hispanic children. It's called Team Spartan Spades, and it's for kids that are overweight, on diabetes, too much sugar, teaching them how to work out, how to eat properly, and how to get along with people in general. And I am so proud to say that Michael is coming on Monday at 10 a.m. Eastern. On the 20th, we have the author of Passion Peril, and we have on the 23rd, Joe Miller, Midnight Call. On the 27th, a medical thriller. And on the 30th, the coronation, and on the 3rd, I got really excited, the Treadstone Rendition. Joshua Hood just booked a show for April 3rd. I read the book yesterday, everybody. And this one is really great. So when things fall into place, why is Mindy arrested, and why would Child Protective Services be involved? I've dealt with them. You don't want to deal with them. Trust me.
Yeah. Yeah, so when Libby's dad leaves, he's high and basically can't drive, and the cops who have been watching Peter's house arrest Mindy's father, and they can't locate her mother because her mother is covered in family who's had an overdose, where their son has had an overdose. She's taken to the police facility and is told that her parents are not located. She will be handed over to Child Protective Services. And of course, she looks it up, she doesn't know anything about it, and she looks it up, she really doesn't like what she reads about. And it's the last thing she wants, mainly because she wants to continue on her adventure with Pablo. But, yeah, that's the threat, is child protection. That is scary.
And I've dealt with Child Protective Services, where they just came in and said, you know, we're taking these children out. I fought for them, and I wouldn't let them go. You have to really know what you're doing, because some of these social workers, trust me, they don't care. So you have to care. So tell us about the ops center, where she works, and what happens when she realizes what her husband has done, and what does she do?
Well, I'll answer the last question first. What she does is nothing. Mindy's mother stays in denial about her husband's addiction. And she makes a lie to both herself and her daughter throughout the book until right at the end. The op shop is the opportunity shop, which is a thrift store close to where I work that serves the hospital, and they sell, you know, people who passed away, their clothes, that sort of thing. It's a thrift shop. And Mindy's mother takes her to do some odd job, you know, but she wants to have her daughter as well, although she can't bring herself to tell her daughter the truth. And so Mindy realizes that, you know, going to the op shop with her mother is just a pretense to see if her mother could get closer to her, and yet she can't tell the truth about her dad. So it's pretty sad.
So Mindy's upset with Pablo. Why does she think he betrayed her? And how did you use technology to solve some of the problems?
Yeah, so Mindy thinks that Pablo betrayed her because he revealed that that Mindy was working with Peter on trying to solve this problem and interfering with the law and that sort of thing. And so she sort of exposed them. And I'm sorry, what was the last? It's the second part of your question.
Well, what happens, how do you use technology to solve the problems? And what is this game that they invented?
Yeah, so because Pablo's mom realizes that his education needs to be to take a, his education needs to be enhanced because of the language difficulty and that sort of thing. He's just not doing well in school, and so she's very enterprising and teaches herself to code, and so she works out a game, a computer game, and she sees Pablo's interest in art, and so she says, well, help me develop these characters in our game. And so she does it on a freelance basis, and she releases it, and a few people are now playing the game and that sort of thing. And Pablo is delighted with it. He loves doing it. And they use this game to evade any detection because nobody knows how to read the code buried within their game. And they make comments to each other through the code in a that drives the game. And so they use the game to update their communications between, you know, the son and the mother.
So what happens that lets us know that there's more to this story, that it's not over yet? And Pablo, he's going to go somewhere else. They're not going to be living near each other anymore, or are they?
Right. So what we find out at the end of the story is that he is in fact going to be taken out of that school, and he's going to be taken to a school more suited to his abilities, which is basically an art school or high school kids. And she, of course, because of the fate of her father, needs to move back to New York City to stay with her mother. And so they do instead split up, and you realize that there's more of the story to come. What happens as a result of that?
Well, how does she feel about going back to living with her mother? What's her real thought on that one?
The character arc, the trajectory of the character of Mindy's mother is that she's basically a liar, and she's been not been truthful with her daughter. And her daughter, because of the kindness and the concern and the honesty of this young daughter, the 12-year-old daughter, she begins to realize that she needs to be upfront with her. And so there's a reconciliation between mother and daughter towards the end of the book.
Well, that's going to take time for trust, too.
And it will take time, absolutely.
So this is a powerful story. And the last couple of books, real book I read in an hour and a half. I just sat down and read it, seriously. Lately it's been taking me too long to read some. So what do you hope young adults and adults will learn after reading this novel? And parents need to be more vigilant. If a child, I know when I taught, if a student came in that was quiet, and all of a sudden the student was acting kind of outgoing or whatever, I made a phone call. I got worried. Something was wrong. And if a student that is outgoing and you wonder why is he so hyperactive gets quiet, I make another phone call. So what can parents and teachers and everyone learn from reading this story? What should they be aware of? And what are the signs that a child might be, you know, on opiates?
Yeah, I mean it's a very good question, and you know I'm certainly not a counselor myself, but certainly what you suggested is exactly the right thing to do. You know, if there's change in behavior, then it needs to be brought to their attention, and parents need to be have some explanation for what this behavior is all about. And the problem is that, you know, in these schools, I read about it every day, where the drugs come into the schools, and they're now making candy in various different colors, and some of that has fentanyl in it. And so what they're trying to do is introduce or create drug culture within young school children now. It's called Rainbow Fentanyl.
Yep.
And it's extremely pervasive and, of course, effective in getting young to take it during parties and that sort of thing. But, of course, many of them overdose.
Well, the thing is this, a lot of them take this stuff or eat this stuff just to belong in a crowd because they're of the peers. And
it becomes something to try out, you know.
That's right.
So it's dangerous stuff.
It's really dangerous. I mean, I went to school not long ago, and I went to for my third master's, and I saw students in this particular school you know, adult with drugs, and I just sort of, you know, walk away. Or do you want to try this? Do you want to try that? And that's scarier. So the opioid crisis is so serious, and it'll always be here. How can the cartels be stopped? And, I mean, I saw it outside my school, drug dealers outside my school trying to sell it to the kids, and I stopped it because, you know, you have your cell phone and call up to the principal, call the police, and you stop it. But that's if you're aware. I mean, I did a lot of things that most people wouldn't even think to do. I mean, I had a student that came up to me one day, and he handed me something in my hand. I go, "You didn't just hand me that, did you?" And he handed me a prophylactic and some medicine in my hand. And I said, "Is this for somebody to get lucky, or are you just trying to tell me that you took it from your house and you wouldn't want to get in trouble?" And I took it, and he didn't get in trouble. I did call his father. I said, "You might be missing this." But kids often do things just to be, you know, heard, and that's what's scary. So how can the cartels be stopped? And what about the sellers that are selling to kids, not so much elementary school, but junior high school and high school outside the school? What should people do to stop them?
Sure. So the from the pharmaceutical point of view, there are some developments now for alternative painkillers that are as effective as opioids.
Mm.
And so that is one thing. If that becomes commercially available and approved by the CDC, et cetera, that will prevent street drugs because there'll be less temptation, or there'll be less, or opioids will be used less prevalently for painkillers. That's the one thing that can be done. Of course, law enforcement with cartels is they're doing what they can, but it's an extremely difficult problem because it's easy to bring those drugs into the country. One of the things that this book will make obvious is that a lot of stuff can come in that is very, very difficult to detect.
It's scary because the first line of defense sometimes, I mean, I hear it. I heard it for myself. The first thing is, "I'll prescribe this, I'll prescribe that." And they don't even think about it. "We'll just prescribe you opiates, you'll feel better." Never in a million years. I'd rather deal with the pain than deal with that. So why is that the first line of defense of doctors, even today? I mean, I heard one the other day when I went in to get something, and they said, "Well, why don't we, you know, prescribe this for this person or that?" And I go, like, "You have to be crazy to take that." And the person took the prescription. Why is that the first line of defense? And you're right, they need to come up with something else. I mean, what's wrong with Tylenol or Motrin or just dealing with it? Why do people think that they have to have opiates in order to survive for pain when you don't know what's going to happen if you take it?
Yeah. It's,
it's scary.
It's a very difficult problem.
It's a problem, unfortunately, that's going to be here forever. And as educators, as a person that is an educator, I still think that there should be lessons that the health teacher does in drugs to talk about them. And I don't know how many schools allow the gym teacher or the health person or the nurse to come up and talk about that. I think there was a teacher that got in trouble in a state for talking about that, for saying that opiates are bad and they shouldn't do this, whatever. And she got in serious trouble, and that's sad. So what is next for all of them? What's going to come out about Mindy and Pablo? Where are they going to wind up next?
So this is a series, the Pablo and Mindy Mysteries. When we meet them again, they both get 20 years old. And so they've gone through their teenage years.
Mm.
Most of the book, we find out what those years were for them. But the current issue is that Pablo has done well. He's graduated from an art school, and he's now working as an industrial designer, and as a an art exhibition on sculpture. He's working for a bicycle company, creating these very advanced carbon graphite bicycle frames, and he, because no money's coming in, but he's getting these offers. He works as a room service waiter at a very exclusive hotel in Manhattan that caters to rock groups and artists. He's doing that while at the same time, Mindy has started working as an intern for a large law firm. And, they're working her butt off because, she's doing 70, 80-hour weeks with research. She's bored out of her mind. She hates her job. And a friend of hers says, why don't you take a break and let's go to the village and visit this art exhibition that's supposed to be so hot. Mm. And she meets them. She hooks. She connects again with Pablo, and Pablo shares with her that he's got a problem because somebody has stolen all of his designs.
Oh, God.
Of his designs has been taken over by somebody else, and his identity's stolen, and he's just sort of flapping in the breeze, doesn't know what to do. And Mindy, knowing the company that she works for deals with these things, suddenly becomes interested in her job again, because now she has a real reason to apply the law in copyright law. So that's the beginning of the next book. That's how it gets going.
When is it coming out?
I think probably this time next year.
Well, that's good. I just hope I'm on the list to get it. I'm very becoming so popular, it's frightening. You know what the problem is? It's not the amount of books that I'm supposed to read. The problem is that book mail's not bringing them. The post office is just not bringing anything. And I've got emails from I don't know how many publicists, like, why didn't you tell us you got the book? Because it didn't come. And once or twice, because I knew I was interviewing the author, I didn't even tell them. I wound up buying the book on Amazon just to have it in case the book didn't come. It was a good thing I did because the book never came. And I don't want to do that, you know, to somebody that's being interviewed. That's not right either. And I have this work ethic. It's from my father. Where can we find out more about you and your work?
The best place is my website, which is Jeffrey Wells Fiction. And I spell my name the English way, Geoffrey, Wells, fiction, one word, .com.
Well, I appreciate this. You just made my whole morning so much better and more brighter. And it's freezing outside, people. It's like 29 degrees, but don't worry about it. I'm going to fix the promo to the show before I send you the link because somehow, like I said before, all the words got spelled wrong. I don't even know what that is. Thank you so much. And if you're interested in doing a panel ever on this, email me and let me know because I am very sure that John Land and a whole bunch of other authors would be more than happy to join in because this is an important topic, and I think that parents need to be more aware of what their children are doing and that if you see a change of behavior one way or the other, you need to make a phone call or find out why. And if you're an educator, you need to be more aware. So thank you, Jeffrey. Everybody have a great day, and bye.